I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
This week on Meat and Three, meet four of our HRN Hall of Fame inductees. These prolific individuals are writers who have changed the way we talk about food. We'll take a look at the journeys that shaped their literary voices.
I was heading off into the unknown to spend my junior year of college in Paris.
We'll explore the culinary landscape they work within.
You know, it was that whole self-made American idea that you can just kind of create a new world from scratch, including a new way of eating.
And look at the transformative effect that their work has on what we eat and where it comes from.
It gets down to management deciding that humane handling is important. You've got to have management that cares. And if management doesn't care, then you're going to have a bunch of bad stuff.
You can learn more about HRN's 10th Anniversary Hall of Fame at heritageradionetwork.org/Hall of Fame. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E.
Hello, and welcome to a special joint episode of Cutting the Curd and the Farm Report, two shows here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Elena Santigade, host and producer of Cutting the Curd.
And I'm Lisa Held, host and producer of The Farm Report.
On today's show, Lisa and I will be co-hosting here in the HRN studio at Roberta's. Our guest today is Celeste Nolan of Laurel Valley Creamery. That one got me. Laurel Valley Creamery in Ohio.
Celeste is a farmer and a cheesemaker. She and her husband bought their farm 15 years ago, and after struggling to make a living selling fluid milk, they introduced cheesemaking as a value-added product to grow and sustain the family farm.
Celeste and her family will also be featured on the Point of View, POV, PBS broadcast debut of Farmsteaders by Shayna Mallett on September 2nd at 10 p.m. So watch out for that, listeners. And Celeste, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're so happy to have you. So
I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. And where are you exactly?
Yeah, like where in the world of Ohio are you located?
I'm in Southeast Ohio in Gallia County. Gallia County borders the Ohio River across from West Virginia in the southeast corner of the state.
Perfect.
Got it.
So we thought that we would start with talking a little bit about the farm and the history. I think from what I understand, it belonged to your husband's family originally. Is that right?
Exactly. My husband's grandparents bought the farm in 1947 after his papa got back from World War II. They moved themselves and their firstborn child here from Boone County, West Virginia, wherein they began dairy farming. They farmed and made a living farming here from 47 until 1990 is when they quit dairy farming. They retired from that into beef cattle, and then his grandfather was killed in a tractor accident in 1994 here on the property. We bought the property in 2001 from his grandparents, or from his grandmother, and then started milking in 2005.
Did the two of you have experience as farmers before that?
I had no experience. I grew up in a rural area, but neither of my parents made their living from farming, and it wasn't anything that I really had any association with. Nick grew up here at the end of the road. We have 110 acres here, and our farmstead, I don't know, a quarter mile down the road is where he grew up at his parents' house. And so his experience was growing up here as the grandson of a dairy farmer.
But I imagine there...
But no professional experience.
Right. So what was the learning curve like getting started?
It was huge. It was, I feel like, I don't know, a group of dairy cows is like a, you know, a group of women. I assume like the general practitioner or the, you know, the people that come in contact with a cross section of women, you know, like 17 to 50, they kind of, you know, they all present with the same problems. And I think, yeah, cows did that for us too. And it was like, once you saw what was happening and what to expect and how to prevent it, there was a learning curve, but I don't know, I feel like cows are kind of predictable.
How many cows do you have on the farm, Celeste?
On the farm, we have about 45 cows. We milk between 20 and 30 cows at a time, and then we raise replacements, and then we milk year-round, so at any one time, we have dry cows and fresh cows.
Got it.
And then different groups of young stock.
Got it. So you got into dairy farming at a time when it's a tough time to be a dairy farmer, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Especially one of your size.
Absolutely. When we bought the farm, my husband worked as a project engineer for a big food conglomerate. Hmm. And we were, you know, we hobby farmed. We had some beef cattle. We sold some hay. I had goats. Goats were my gateway animal.
Did you make cheese with the goat's milk?
I did, just like in a small scale in my kitchen. Never anything, not near at the scale that I do now. But I did, I played with goat's milk. But I didn't really, none of the things that I did in the kitchen translated to the cheese house, whether it was with cow's milk or or goat's milk.
Would you say that about hobby farming in general? Like just the stuff you guys were doing before... I mean, to us New Yorkers, that sounds pretty dramatic. Like, oh, we just had a few beef cattle and some goats. Like, that's farming.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, the difference, in my opinion, like, when it was hobby farming, I had an emotional attachment to the animals more so than I have, like, a working relationship with them now. Mm. We're both reliant on each other in a very important way. And I think I don't think as hobby farmers, I wasn't as reliant on them. I was more like, I'll pay anything it takes, just make this goat okay. Right. Versus now, like, well, it's not the best economic decision to put, you know, good money after bad. If something, you know, that, you know, if you, if you can predict
like
the outcome,
you have to do a cost benefit on things in a different way. Makes sense.
In a different way. Yeah.
So what made you decide to switch from hobby farming to making it really your business?
Well, my husband lost his job.
That's often the precipice of something exciting.
Right.
Exciting, exactly. It was he had a paternity leave after our second child was born, and he went back and worked that week. And then they're like, here's your severance. Good luck to you. And so then it was, and we had bought the farm recently. We had a mortgage. We had, you know, we had ties here. He had moved back to the area. He has they're adults now, but they were, my stepson and daughter lived here in the area. It was like, he could have looked for another job, but we decided that we were going to stay here and make this work. It had worked for his grandparents. We could do it too. So after, everybody that he knew tried to talk us out of it. His grandparents, his parents.
Really?
They all told us. Oh yeah, they told us what a terrible idea it was. We went to a few dairy farms in the area. They all said, "Oh, yeah, y'all are silly. Wow. What are you doing?" Wow. A lot of people told us it was a bad idea, and I mean, it was financially. We started out milking 20 cows. We bought up to 60 cows, and we're milking them. And it was just, you know, it was It was not sustainable, exactly, and it wasn't adding up. And then when I had a few years later, I had my third daughter. We had a second mortgage. We'd max out the cards again. it was like do or die time. And that's when we got the money, and cheese making seemed like the best thing for us to do. There was with fluid milk, you have to have a market, you know, the day you make it.
Right.
With cheese making, you have
Some time to build it.
There.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was also it took the least amount of capital.
In terms of your options for how to change things or grow the business.
Exactly. Or what we could do with the milk how we could make it. It seemed like it made the most amount of sense with the skill set that both my husband and I had, or thought we had.
Does that indicate that you've been humbled by the cheese making experience?
Oh, absolutely. Milk is very humbling. Cheese and teenagers are the two things that make you realize you have zero control.
I don't think I've heard that comparison before, but I have a feeling that we have a lot of listeners who are nodding their heads or like saying, yes, who are in the same boat.
That is my boat. Yeah, exactly. Everybody can jump in. We can sink it together. Teenagers and cheese have both been a challenge.
So Celeste, you mentioned that, you know, that you had sort of looked at the options and cheese making was the most cost-effective way to move forward. Was there like a final, like do or die moment? Was there something that prompted you to take that plunge? What was that moment like when you decided, okay, we're going to go for it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I decided when we were able to like secure the financing to do it. I think that option, and I think a lot of things happened when I had our third child. Mm-hmm. She was born prematurely. I spent some time away from the farm, and my husband and stepson were doing the day-to-day milking. My mother-in-law was caring for our two other young children, and I think during that time is when everybody... I guess they decided it while I was at the hospital. That's what I like to tell myself.
Welcome home with the baby.
And they're like, oh, yeah, here, start making cheese. We're going to start making cheese. You got this? So start buying some equipment. We got it.
So,
and that's pretty well what we did.
Interesting. What did you expect from cheese making, and how has it gone?
I like to manage my expectations. So, cheese making has gone fine. I've learned so many things, about milk, about myself, about business, about, I don't even know that I can list all the things that I've learned. I've learned a lot of things, and I describe myself, or my husband keeps telling me to describe myself as self-taught. And so I've learned more from my mistakes than I have my successes.
Yeah. Well, I think that's also how I learned in my own little, very, very small compared with your cheese making sort of explorations. But I think it's almost, for me at least, it was a stronger way to learn. It was like, once you see how something can go badly, you understand the thing better, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. And where, if you've got any control, where it's at and where where you have to capture it.
Right. And if you have enough time to figure out that trial and error to get a few good batches going, then it really works. So did you take any cheese making classes at all, or was it really sort of studying, getting advice, or how did you learn in the beginning?
Well, we got our license in September, and I made consistently bad cheese until I took Peter Dixon's class in November. And then I learned a lot there, and I feel like I learned more there because I had the few months of mistakes under my belt, or, you know, experience under my belt.
You knew how it looked and felt, probably, at least more than if you just walked in before even trying, I'm sure.
Right. And I feel like I knew questions to ask that applied to my situation or applied to my, to my equipment, so to speak. And, I learned a lot from that class. And I still mess up batches of cheese seasonally.
Everybody does.
Yeah. And, I'm definitely a work in progress, but it's nice to be able to take milk, which as a commodity doesn't have any value,
mm-hmm.
and to do something, that people seem to really value and appreciate. And I also can mostly pay my bills with it.
Hmm. Who's Peter Dixon? You know, I think Farm Report listeners, you guys, I can see Elena shaking her head like, yeah, of course. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know who that is. We gotta tell Farm Report
That's
listeners.
True. We have to explain how to explain who is Peter Dixon. Well, Celeste, do you want to?
I think you should do it. I think you'll do a great
well,
job.
Peter is a storied cheesemaker. I mean, he and his wife Rachel now make cheese at Parish Hill Creamery is the name of their creamery. And Peter has been involved in cheese education in Vermont for decades and also has consulted with a lot of cheesemakers as they've learned. He hosts classes himself. And, you know, Celeste, you're one of the class of people who are part of this Peter Dixon incubator, and you know, a lot of people have gone on to have great success after taking his classes or working with him. And he just does really, really interesting projects. We'll add some links to, we've done shows with him on Cutting the Curd. So
for
Farm Report listeners, maybe we could add those into the show notes.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And you didn't tell us what kind of cheese you're making.
Yes, we're very curious.
So I make fresh and raw milk cheeses. It feels like it's summertime. All I'm doing is making fresh cheeses. We do some fresh cheddar curds. We do fresh mozzarella. Mm. I make a soft cheese called Cloverton. It's a lactic curd cheese. And then I consistently make one we call Country Jack, which is a aged, it's a Monterey Jack style cheese, and some an Alpine style aged raw milk cheese. Yeah, those are the core. I'll start making some Pepper Jack here just as soon as milk volume allows it, and I do that a couple seasonal cheeses as well.
That's really fun. And how do you you mentioned that you've learned a lot about business. How do you get these cheeses out into the market? Are you building more of like a local distribution customer base, or how has that side of things gone for you as you've been making cheese?
That's been an evolution, I guess, as well. But we self-distribute all of our cheeses. We sell most everything within 100 miles of the farm. We do a farmer's market, a regional farmer's market, the Athens Farmer's Market in southeastern Ohio, and then sell to restaurants and small or independently owned restaurants and stores, I don't know, within the 100 mile.
Mm-hmm.
And then, we self-distribute all of our products, and
wow,
I don't know.
That's a lot.
Yeah, we hustle.
Yes. Oh dear.
Oh.
I think it's time for a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment with more from Celeste Nolan of Laurel Valley Creamery.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk, cooked, pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Opening team there.
No way.
All right. Welcome back to this special episode of Cutting the Curd and the Farm Report. I'm Lisa Held.
And I'm Elena Santigade. And you heard us doing some chatting there here in the studio. We were saying we were used to being in here alone. So it's amazing to, you know, be here and then with Celeste on the phone. It's like we're having a little party today.
Yeah, it's great.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. So before the break, Celeste, we were talking a lot about all of the many, many things you're doing.
Amazing.
Running the farm, making the cheese, running, selling it all yourself. It just seems like a lot.
Not to mention raising three children.
Right, raising children. Go ahead.
There's four children. And oh, then
four
my
children.
Husband, four children. And then, but my husband and partner, like, we do all of this together.
Right.
There's absolutely no way that I could do all the things that you listed.
Well, right, and that's what
alone.
That's what I was going to ask is, do you have sort of a division of labor? Like, do you focus on one thing and Nick focuses on something else? Or, like, how do you split things up and manage all those different responsibilities?
Well, we do. There's definitely some crossover, but Nick definitely manages the farm. He milks twice a day. He puts up all of the hay, does all the crop work, he does all of that with the help of our two teenage sons, which is a great deal of help, and it's, you know, a great deal of teenage sons. So, and then he also manages our Athens. We're kind of split up where we have three delivery areas, two of them that are about 50 miles away and then another that's 100. And he does one 50 miles away. I do the one 100 miles away. And then we both do, or our employee does the other 50 mile away one. So we kind of split up there.
How often are you making those deliveries?
Weekly.
Okay.
We go to all three locations once a week and make deliveries. The days that are shorter are also the days we do the farmer's market. So it's, you know, each one is a full day's work that we do in between cheese making. Like Nick does the Saturday markets, and that's the day a week that I milk. We have some crossover there, but we all work together. It's division of labor, but none of it's possible without the other.
Right.
And also the benefit of having a husband and two teenagers is I never have to do anything that's gross or farm. The farm related gross stuff has been delegated.
That's great.
And so, it is great.
Wait, so like, what's an example of something really gross on your farm that you don't have to do?
Tell us about one gross thing that you're happy you're not doing right now.
Well, I'm shoveling shit.
Farmer.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I haven't lanced an abscess in a long time. The stinkier stuff I can kind of avoid. Yeah, I don't castrate pigs anymore.
That's good. Yeah. Congratulations,
I know.
Celeste.
I know. Is, thank you.
That's like the equivalent. It's like the farm equivalent of getting a promotion.
Yeah.
It's like I don't castrate
exactly.
pigs anymore.
Exactly.
I don't close the shop anymore.
Right.
Oh, I love it.
Right.
You know, one question that I had that just came up listening to you describe all of this. You know, I'm realizing that before you bought the farm. You know, you mentioned your husband's job. It sounded like you didn't work together, but now your work and home lives are completely intertwined and overlapping. Is there anything about that dynamic that was particularly either something that was really tricky to adapt to or something that kind of surprised you in how easy it was with working together and living together in this new setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, it's still tricky. You know, that's what I did the math the other day. We shipped milk the day after my 27th birthday.
Wow.
And I've been self-employed since I was 27. And I don't even know what it would be like to work with anybody else. It doesn't even feel, it feels like it was like a lifetime ago that, you know, everybody that I work with, I'm related to, or you know, like I deal with them not just as a 4-hour or 8-hour shift. Mm-hmm. Everything is 24 hours. There's not a break in it, and it's tricky. It's all the highs and all the lows. I think it's you get every bit of it that I don't know that you would get in the 8-hour or the 10 or 12-hour workday.
Sort of magnified.
We all see all sides of each other.
Was that something you wanted? Was that something you wanted in, you know, that you had thought about in life? Was like having a family business of some kind? Had you ever imagined that before?
No, I hadn't really imagined it. And I don't think until you see, you know, the effects of milking every day, twice a day. I see the effects of that on my husband and on my sons and on the effect of, you know, working together and not, dairy isn't, it's not a job. It's like, it's a lifestyle. It's a, you know, where we don't ever leave or separate ourselves from the farm. You know, it's every 12 hours, someone's got to be here to milk.
Right.
And it's, I didn't, and then also it's like, you know, people work at home or work with their kids, but it's like, I rely on my kids.
Right,
I rely on them to help us milk, to make a living. And it's tricky to balance all of it.
Yeah.
And to, you know, to still, the parenting part of it is a whole new ball game. Like every,
there's like a different level of consequence when there's friction, I'm sure. You know, it's like it affects so much more than everyone's mood or the dinner table, you know?
Right. It's like, we're going to all be mad at each other and then we're going to go work in this barn together for 2 hours.
Or
we're
sort all going to, sounds healthy.
Yeah.
That's true. You can't get away from it.
Right.
Yeah.
Better than locking yourself in the bedroom.
Right.
Right. Yeah, well, there's still a few hours left for that, too. They are teenagers.
It might be too early to know, but I'm curious if you think that your kids will continue on and take over the family business at some point and, you know, be sort of the next generation of farmers.
Yeah, I would love that, but I want them to have some quality of life. Mm-hmm. I want there to be them to have some, I don't know, work-life balance, if that's a thing. And I my goal or my ideal is to have, you know, the farm in some way that they can take over that's more sustainable than the way that I'm currently doing it. And if I can work out some of those bugs and get it into a place that more than one of them, or you know, that they can take over and be successful at, but do it better.
That's a great goal.
That's what I want to do.
It's a goal that many guests on Cutting the Curd have had and have actually achieved or are aiming toward. You know, I feel like it's a totally achievable goal, like as wild as it sounds. I mean, especially given, like, it sounds like you walked into something so new to it. It was this one thing, the dairy farming piece, and then to already have sort of transformed the business is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it is. And I, you know, it's some days you have to like remind yourself of that more than others.
Yeah.
As to look at the accomplishments versus the challenges.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think of, after going through all of that, you know, we on the Farm Report, we've done a lot of shows on dairy farmers who are struggling and, you know, what pathways there are for making farms more profitable. What do you think of this route, like for other dairy farmers who are trying to figure out what to do and how to sell their milk? Like, would you recommend this path, like, you know, going into cheese making or some sort of value added product?
I don't know how to answer that question consistently. There's no way that we could have done this for the past 10 years without doing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Is it sustainable for the next 20 years? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And is it the way to break or to fix the food system? I don't think that's the case either. You know, like,
right.
I don't know how to replicate this on a scale. Like, I take cheese to kitchens across cities, and I go in walk-ins, and I see how much cheese they're buying. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I see the shelves of cheese and which percent of it's mine, mm-hmm. where I'm at, like how much I can make, how much, you know, we're limited by how much land we have and how many cows we're milking and all of those things. I know how much I can make and sell, mm-hmm. but I see at what percentage of this is, you know, I don't know. I don't mm-hmm. know how. But then I also look around in my rural community and I see empty dairy farm after empty mm-hmm. dairy farm after empty dairy farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear people talk about how, you know, it was a viable thing. So many people raised their families doing that here.
Right.
What's changed?
One question I have is on... about that local community. Have you found any other, you know, potential cheesemakers or new cheesemakers or people who are considering that same route in the community? And I'm asking more from a distribution sort of idea or perspective. I know that farmstead cheesemakers in the Midwest have found success with that kind of consolidating cheese and building basically a community of cheesemaking farmers who are making it work that way. Have a community like that in any close assemblage?
We don't. There's in northern Ohio, there's some cooperatives, some people making cheese on a larger scale than us, but they're still just buying, from my understanding, they just buy commodity milk.
Mm-hmm.
There's a small independent fluid processor near us that pays a premium for milk.
Mm.
And that's been, you know, they've struggled and succeeded just like anybody does.
Right.
I feel like, you know, especially on small scales, you face different challenges. There's loads and loads of empty dairy farms and what we've worked on and what we've concentrated on the past 10 years is where we're at now. But the way that, yeah, I could see my kids or my family or anybody else taking it, I think people would milk cows if they could make a living doing it. They did it for a long time. Why wouldn't they still do it?
Right.
You know, it's just, yeah,
right.
It's
the,
just
the
scale
money
and
part
quality
has
of life.
Changed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it's, you can't do things for free or at a loss for only so long. And that's what the dairy industry is, you know, faced
right.
for. But that's what the dairy industry is faced for, you know, 40 years, 50
yeah,
years. How
right.
do we, yeah. I don't know how to fix that.
Yeah, it's so true.
Well, you're doing your part and you're milking your cows and making good cheese. And, you know, it's.
Yes.
Yeah, it's. I don't think anyone quite has figured out exactly how to fix.
Yeah,
you know, there's so many moving parts.
It's really interesting. I think also like sort of agritourism has become something that people bring up on air with me a lot, is like new ways to bring people to the farm. To also, it's sort of like fulfills two goals. It's like a sort of revenue stream, but also a way, I think one of the missing pieces is how little people sometimes realize about what a farm life is really like and what goes into it. And when you're deciding to have grass-fed cows or to make raw milk cheese, like what does that mean for how you, you know, run your farm and operate your dairy? And I'm excited because I think your episode of Farmsteaders is going to really highlight that about what you're doing at Laurel Valley.
Yeah, I hope that I don't know, is a way that people can connect to not just our family, but, you know, as a reflection of people doing the same thing across the country or across the world.
Right. And maybe listeners of the Farm Report and Cutting the Curd, if anybody's looking to go venture out to Southeast Ohio, it looks like there's some land.
Yeah.
We could have first generation farmers adding to this community. I think for those who are tired of their desk jobs, I mean, that's the biggest complaint we hear here in the city. Just go for it.
Right.
Try it. You know? Wow.
Exactly. That's all we can do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Like milking cows that first winter that we did it, it was a real like, oh, you can do something.
Yeah.
It was a big challenge. And it was one you had to face twice every day.
Yeah. How long would you say it took you to get used to the rhythm of that?
Oh, I don't think I'm still not used to the rhythm.
Really? Amazing.
Well, I got so far out of it. You know, that's when the kids were little, when I had the second two. After I had my second, my third child, I didn't milk every day. Mm. It was, you know, my stepson was there and my husband, and then my boys were older, and then I started making cheese, and it just has been, so my day-to-day is very different on that aspect. It's, you know, cheese making isn't something that I have to do every part of it every day.
Right. Cheese making is like you do a little thing and then you let it be. Then you do something else and then you let it be.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you try to be productive between those let it be's.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, I don't know, I'm more successful at that than others.
Aren't we all?
Right.
It's amazing what I think I can accomplish in the half hour between two other things, and then somehow...
Right. What actually happens?
Yeah, somehow it's like, oh, wait.
What happened?
Yeah, it's not even 18 minutes.
Well, that is a universal experience. Rural or urban, good, doesn't matter.
Definitely. Well, good. Celeste, I think we have to wrap up. Thank you for sharing all of your accomplishments and successes and challenges with us today on the air.
Yeah, this is...
Well, thanks for, asking me questions and letting me talk about myself. It was lovely.
No, it's really interesting, and I think so many of the listeners of both of our shows are curious about the rural farming life, are concerned with it, want to support it, want to understand more about what it's like. So we really appreciate you just opening that up. And also on your episode of Farmsteaders, it seems like you really opened up to the filmmaker, and it's a really intimate portrait, and we can't wait to see it.
Definitely.
Yeah, I hope that you all watch and enjoy it, and realize it's a very accurate and intimate depiction of of life here.
And listeners, that's going to be airing on September 2nd at 10 p.m. on PBS. Again, it's called Farmsteaders, and it's part of the POV PBS series, which is a really interesting series in and of itself. That's like something for a whole other show, because there's a lot of good stuff there. But, well, thanks again, Celeste.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this special co-hosted show. I know I had fun. What about you, Lisa?
Awesome. I love it.
Please keep the conversation going with both of us on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Cutting the Curd, and email is cuttingthecurd@heritageradionetwork.org.
And you can follow the Farm Report on Instagram or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I'll be back next week with a timely episode on the current threat of 100% tariffs on cheeses imported from the European Union.
And I'll be finishing out the Farm Report summer season with Chris Starkus, a farmer and chef visiting from Denver, Colorado. See you then.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.